Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher, and on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Adam Carroll. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, very cold start to the day. One of the more colder starts that we've seen in a while because of the snow cover, of course, but we also had clear skies overnight. Those two things just are a recipe for a very cold start to the day. We are seeing other temperatures here across the Wasatch back. You mentioned the 3 below in Silver Creek. I just saw 4 below at Summit Park. We also have 1 below in Camas, 5 below Timberlake. So we've got some very cold temperatures here to start off the day in the Wasatch back. But mainly sunny for the most part today. But we will see the clouds start to increase as we head into the latter half of the day. Quiet, dry. We do have a new winter storm on the way. Now, this will bring more or less a series of waves, or what we call short waves, into the area where they're going to come in. One tonight, where we'll have a far northern Utah and into our Wasatch Mountains. We'll have some snow shower activity. Not expecting much from this one. There's not a lot of moisture with this little wave that comes in. But the second one has a little bit more juice to it. That comes in later tomorrow afternoon into the evening hours, which is where a winter weather advisory is now in effect at 5 p.m. tomorrow. This actually does include the Park City area and the Wasatch back, including Heber as well, because it may have an impact to your evening commute tomorrow with the development of the snow. This will lead to snow continuing into Saturday, and in the 3 to 6 inch range is what's looking like going to be the case with this storm system that arrives. And wave two will start it, and that will be, I mentioned, after 5 p.m. the mountain passes will deteriorate quickly, and then we'll see that snow continuing overnight. With the third wave coming in Saturday morning, we'll stay on the much colder side of things as well through the duration of this event, with Park City staying in the upper 20s today, tomorrow, then only in the lower 20s here on Saturday. Now, we are going to have winter driving conditions here beginning late Friday into Saturday, so that's something to keep in mind throughout the area, not just over the mountain passes. But the temperatures will stay cold as well, even behind that storm system that comes in, and will stay cold on Saturday as things wind down, but we'll see sunnier skies, and we'll start to then warm behind it, as not much in the way of storminess is expected thereafter, except for the gradual warming and the sunshine coming back into play. But another nice little storm for the area. 6 to 12 is the likely scenario for our mountains in and around Park City. So all of this is good news, because with a drier pattern setting up behind it, we need it.
Sure do. Thank you. And with a look in the backcountry on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, it's Trent. Good morning, Trent.
Hey, good morning. Yesterday a trace to 5 inches of new snow fell roughly across throughout the Wasatch Range. It actually seems like the Park City Ridgeline did pretty well and came in just about 5 inches, while other areas just got an inch or two. But as you just heard, it is cold out there. Mountain temperatures are just above 0 Fahrenheit. We have wind chills in the negative digits. The winds are currently blowing northeast, which is a little bit of an odd direction for us here in Utah. And they're spinning those anemometers roughly 10 to 15 miles per hour, gusting in the 20s across those upper elevation ridgelines. yesterday, we had no new avalanches reported from the backcountry. And I'm sure you're tired of listening to it, because I'm getting pretty tired of talking about it. But, you know, it is what it is. And in the mountains, we're dealing with this weak layer still. The snowpack is adjusting to last week's heavy new snow and becoming more and more stable every day. However, the poor snowpack structure, which just means really strong snow over weak snow, remains in place across much of our mountains in northern Utah. And the most suspect slopes are still going to continue to be on the northern half of the compass, so those shady aspects, and in places where the snowpack is a little shallower, so like Park City Ridgeline is a great example, areas in Mill Creek. And if we think about it through the state, areas of Logan, the Uintas, and especially down on the Manti skyline, where our snowpack is a little bit shallower, humans are still really affecting that weak layer, and we're seeing avalanches being triggered. Now, the likelihood of triggering a deep and dangerous avalanche is going down, and I'm speaking to the central Wasatch, but if you do trigger an avalanche on any faceted weak layer, it's likely to be unsurvivable. So these avalanches, they're tree-snapping, bone-crushing avalanches that really shouldn't be messed with. we're sort of entering this weird era of low probability, meaning your chances are pretty low of doing it, but if you do trigger it, it's a very high consequence. Personally, I'm not really ready, nor am I willing to trust any steep northerly facing terrain. I'm fine with waiting. You know, it's just one of those dangerous snowpack years, and really avoidance is the key. So for today, we issued our first moderate avalanche danger, which not really sure, but it's been at least 30 days where we've been at considerable or higher. So we'll have a scary moderate danger today at the mid and upper elevations. The avalanche danger, like I said, is most prevalent on those shady aspects at the mid and upper elevations. It will remain possible for humans to trigger a large and deadly avalanche today. So my travel advice would be, you know, you really need to have careful snowpack evaluation. You should have cautious route finding and be very conservative in your decision-making skills today, even though we're only at a moderate danger. And like I said, other areas throughout the state even have a higher or more elevated danger. So be sure to get the full forecast at utahavalanchecenter.org if you're heading out and about.
Thanks, Trent. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Stay tuned. In just a minute, we'll be checking in with Summit County Council Member Melina Stevens. Later on, Snyderville Basin Planning Commission Chairman Ryan Dickey with an update on Tuesday's meeting. Finally, Park City Film Director Katie Wang has details about their reopening of the Jim Santee Auditorium for private screenings. Stay tuned. Well, the Summit County Council yesterday took up the Dakota Pacific Project at Kimball Junction and was scheduled to hear from the different Dakota Pacific subcommittees. On the phone with an update, I have Council Member Melina Stevens. Good morning, Melina.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the discussion with developers went on about an hour and 15 minutes past the scheduled time. Can you give us some idea where the council is at this point?
So at this point, Dakota Pacific had gone back to the original proposal that they had brought to the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission well over a year ago that included some elements that would require a land swap, would have more public benefits, such as a new public facility within the center, more walkability, transit center, and some other components. And so it was the first time that this council as a whole was able to review that and discuss that particular iteration of the plan. And so there was lots of questions. Several different subcommittees had met regarding different elements of the plan, including kind of the massing and density, some of the other really key components of this traffic transportation. The affordable housing component, we are still waiting to meet on. That will occur early next week, and so we'll have more information and discussions on that within the next couple of weeks, I'm sure.
Yeah. So do you support then Dakota going back to their earlier concept? I mean, a concept I believe that you were in favor of as a planning commissioner.
So the initial iteration of the Dakota Pacific project was a lot better than the current iteration that they had gotten to. Part of the reason for that is that there were a lot more benefits to that to the county. They had a traffic center that could potentially be incorporated, more of a gateway to the Snyderville Basin. Public facilities, gathering spaces were increased. And so I'm in favor of anything that's going to create more public benefit and create a more vibrant space.
Yeah, but the reason they went to the new plan was because of the land swap involved. So what's changed with that?
That's something as a council that we'll be considering. We have no other news, no decisions have been made, but that's something that will be under consideration.
Okay, but again, I mean, Dakota Pacific must have not wanted to wait. Is that why they moved forward with a different plan then?
Because the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission is not within their purview to participate in land swaps, they were encouraged by staff to create a plan that could be approved by the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission.
Okay. At the end of the evening, County Council Member Glenn Wright said that the process is looking clunky to him, as he put it. He suggested that A subcommittee of councilor members Doug Clyde and Chris Robinson meet with staff and developers and work out a plan. Doug and Chris sounded like they were willing. Roger Armstrong definitely didn't like the idea. What's your position?
I would like to see, really for the public as well as for the applicant, some sort of clear direction and opportunity to be able to see what is going to become of this project. The fact that we're back at the beginning of this project in the initial iteration, I think is frustrating. I would suspect on all parts, having been involved in this process personally for over a year and a half, I would really like to see some clear direction and some clear constructive process made possible for the applicant to know what's realistically going to be approved or the likelihood of that, and also for the public to be able to have some clear sense of what's really going to be put there, because we've seen several different iterations now of this plan. The public has been extremely involved. We've had multiple members of the public that have been following this process from the very, very beginning, the first planning commission meeting, coming to every single meeting to both take notes, to provide comments when that was appropriate. And I think that the public deserves to have an answer as far as what is going to happen, instead of being in this limbo that we've been in for the last couple of years.
Yeah, it sure seems like we're going round and round without making much headway. So this process that we decided that to work with subgroups, is that effective?
So I believe the intention behind the subgroups, and this, from what I understand, the intentionality was just for a couple of meetings to kind of parse through certain large elements that have been problematic with this project for different members of the public and just haven't been fleshed out, such as the affordable housing, traffic and transportation, some of the massing and density issues. And I think with meeting with different commissioners, and the way we parse that out has been really according to skill set. So we have people that have a high propensity for those specific areas on those different subcommittees. So they can ask some of those questions, flesh out some of the issues, bring that back to the entire council for further discussion, and so that the public can have all of that information as well. So I think having a few meetings in the subcommittees is likely to be effective. Having an entire subcommittee, I would agree with Roger, having an entire subcommittee that is going to determine what direction we're going is likely going to create more problems, as there's five members of the commission that, three other people that would need to sign off and agree with that direction. So I think from what I understand, where we ended, we were going to have some special meetings with the entire council, the applicant, that would be public meetings, so we could kind of parse through it and get to a place where we have a better idea of where we're going with this more quickly.
Yeah, you did mention that the affordable housing will be addressed in more detail next week. You and Roger Armstrong, though, are in this group looking at affordable housing. I guess, what will it take to convince you that the 1,100 residential units satisfy provision 2.3, or is this even an issue? I mean, does that even need to be considered? Because what that provision requires is that there needs to be a compelling countervailing benefit.
So Summit County Attorney's Office has stated that is not, because these are current entitlements, there's already density that's allocated to this parcel, that 2.3 is not applicable. I know there are some other opinions on the council regarding that. It may be, I think there's some question. The approach that it feels like we're taking at this point on a council is to create as much public benefit, countervailing public benefit, as possible within this project. Doug brought up yesterday that, that this project is unlikely to solve all of these issues that we have as far as affordable housing and traffic and transportation, but we're working to get to a place where it doesn't create harm and that it does provide some increased service in those aspects.
All right. And then regarding transit and transportation, can the council tell us that if Dakota Pacific is approved, that the traffic clusters that we see there will be improved?
That's something that we're working on. And I think it's a key component is the work that Caroline Rodriguez and her team have been doing with UDOT at looking at the key intersections on 224 and looking at the traffic patterns. Because right now, those Olympic Parkway and Ute Boulevard are already failing some of the time because we have these choke points that are not allowing traffic to flow through onto the freeway and is backing up sometimes for a mile. And so in my mind, we need to address that regardless of what happens with the Dakota Pacific project. And if we don't, there's going to be increasing issues regardless of what happens on that parcel. So we're working on that and seeing if there's some sort of way that Dakota Pacific could also aid with that. Also recognizing that as a developer, it's not their responsibility to again entirely solve that problem, which is why it's going to take a collaboration between them and the county and UDOT and potentially other partners to deal with that traffic issue in those intersections.
All right. The council also discussed setting up some kind of a community development agency, basically to pay for projects with increment financing, much like a redevelopment agency. Is this something that we're going to pursue?
I believe at this point we're getting additional information from the county attorney's office regarding what would be involved. That was essentially the extent of that. We didn't have the additional information in front of us, so I would anticipate that we would get the additional information, parse through it publicly, and see if that's a viable option or a desirable option.
All right. On another item, the council received a presentation from Connect Summit County. You asked about a finding in the survey that males under 35 don't know about mental health services and are reluctant to seek them out. Do we need to do a better job here?
Yeah, I think that we really do. And that was the intention, from what I understood, with Connect doing the survey, with Connect presenting the survey to us, that males and those under 35, which from my interpretation of the survey was both male and female under 35, were less likely to reach out for services and had less knowledge regarding the services available. And I thought it was very interesting because generationally, it's become more acceptable socially to seek out mental health services, have those discussions over the last 20, 25 years. And so the fact that those under 35 were less willing to reach out, I thought was curious. We did have a subsequent discussion regarding some of that potentially being with our service workers that don't have insurance and perhaps don't have the same connection to those resources, and how we can better reach out to our service workers and ensure that they are given the support and just the awareness of what's out there to help them as they're serving our community.
Okay. And then Utah legislature over in about a week. Any impressions that you had after watching the proceedings?
It's definitely been an interesting process. There's been a lot of fascinating bills that have taken place over this year, a lot having to do with police and land use, some interesting billboard laws. So it's going to be very interesting to see where things land, especially with the end of the session, bills being resurrected as we saw last night, and things being sometimes passed through very quickly. So I think there's been lots of projects and progress that's been made. Our staff's done an incredible job with both keeping us posted, but also advocating for the county and things that are going to be, beneficial or against things that would be very detrimental. And so I'm just very grateful that we have the team as a county that we do to be able to provide that service for our citizens.
All right. Anything else you'd like to mention?
Really, really grateful for our staff. Also of note, we did last night look at a CPACE program, which would provide additional funding sources to support sustainability projects that are more sustainable within the community, which I think it will be an interesting experiment and also very exciting that as a community, we have the focus and support to really try to provide products that are more sustainable and can provide lasting impact for the county.
Okay. Melina, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Melina Stevens, a member of the Summit County Council. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, Tuesday night's virtual State of Park City address by Mayor Andy Bierman offered a journey through time connecting the city's modern problems like traffic and housing affordability with lessons learned or not learned in the past. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more.
Park City Mayor Andy Bierman characterized 2020 as a year of big little things on Tuesday night, where although many of the city's larger goals for the year were delayed due to the COVID-19 pandemic, small incremental progress on a number of key city priorities were made. Instead of breaking ground on new construction projects, a new housing resolution was passed last fall. Bierman also said smaller things like starting a Spanish language Facebook page for city government actually made a big difference in engaging Park City's Spanish-speaking community. Throughout Tuesday evening's presentation, Bierman also posed a few questions directly to the virtual audience. When did traffic get so bad, and what year did housing become unaffordable, were both asked. For many of today's Parkites, these issues have only manifested themselves in recent years, but the mayor used newspaper headlines from as far back as the 1960s to illustrate that, in fact, the city has been grappling with many of the same questions for decades. Bierman spoke with KPCW on Wednesday morning and said what sets today apart from years past is just how tangled and costly these problems have gotten to solve. He added just because the problems are not new, the community should not hesitate to work towards solving them.
Where we're faced today, I think the challenges of traffic and housing and are more complex than they ever were. They're more expensive, but that doesn't mean we should back down. And in fact, I think we the idea of being bold is important because you look at traffic, we can add all the buses we want. We can try to squeeze out efficiencies. But the reality is, as long as we're a car-centric town that's located in a narrow valley with no parking and only two roads in, we're going to have traffic to some degree. So we need to start to reconsider how our town functions and see if we can come up with a new vision where we're a car-optional town and we have better ways to move people around if we truly want to eradicate traffic.
Becoming a car-optional town by 2030 is a lofty goal, but Bierman pointed to the possibility of large satellite parking lots and more dedicated bus lines in and out of the city as ways to eventually get there. How to effectively balance Park City's growth with maintaining the mountain town feel it's so famous for is another issue that is not new, but will be a central topic for Bierman and his colleagues at City Hall going forward. At a Q&A session with city councilors after the presentation, Councilmember Max Doyle said there are no easy answers, but added that closing the door to all growth is not the answer either.
It's a perpetual battle for unique places like Park City, I think. And if somebody has a silver bullet solution, we're wide open. But I think that coming up with the critical priorities that we have, sort of coming up with a firm identity for who we are and who we want to be, and trying to elect people who have Park City's interests in mind, but also not forget that we're not just trying to shut the gate. You know, we need to change with the times and we need to be willing to grow into the future.
Fellow council member Tim Henney added that Park City's community is the reason why the city has been so successful and why so many people and businesses want to call it home.
And I think it's in part, it's calling out what we already know and recognizing the reality of what is, which is everything is built on the authentic nature of our community. And that's the local culture of our community, the relationships, the neighborhoods that keep our fabric of our community robust and strong. Everything is built upon that.
The first major tests for City Hall in tackling these key community priorities in 2021 will be the ongoing discussions around the proposed Arts and Culture District at the corner of Bonanza Drive and Kearns Boulevard, as well as an extensive proposal to develop the base area of Park City Mountain Resort. Ballooning construction costs and community concerns about the effects of both projects on traffic and quality of life in Park City have given local officials pause. Discussions at the Park City Planning Commission and City Council on these topics are expected to stretch well into the spring. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Well, as we've reported, the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission had a long meeting on Tuesday, hearing from residents about the proposed Highland Flats development for 410 rental units off of Highland Drive. On the phone with a recap of that meeting and what's next, I have Planning Commission Chairman Ryan Dickey. Good morning, Ryan.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. Good to be with you.
Yeah, so on Tuesday, you started at 4:30 in the afternoon, went for 6 hours with just a couple of breaks. About 55 people spoke during the Highland Flats discussion, virtually all of them opposed to the project. So how does the Planning Commission now consider this? I mean, you are not allowed to consider public clamor as a reason to deny or forward a positive, a negative recommendation.
Yeah, good question, Leslie. I would say I think we are able to consider public input for legislative action. So when it comes to the general plan amendment specifically, we'd be listening to the public. So I think we will take that into account. And we did have a lot of public comment. And sort of looking back at my notes, it was a long list of mostly objections, as you note, from the community.
Well, planning.
You asked about process from here. So, by the time we got done with the public hearing, it was 10 o'clock, and I think we made an initial step to get into the discussion among the commissioners about sort of thoughts on the project and the process to getting to a vote. And we've gotten a lot of comments since then of, hey, we had a 4 or 5 hour public hearing. How come you guys didn't make a decision? I think it's important, for the community to understand whether that decision is an approval or a denial. It's important for us to create a strong record of consideration and fact that support the decision, have it on the record. And that's important for a lot of reasons. There's, just sort of good planning hygiene, but certainly in support of an appeal of that decision, you want to have a strong record of the reasons that the commissioners voted the way that they did.
So the Planning Commission won't make the final decision. The Planning Commission, however, does make a recommendation to County Council. So under the code, do you think the project is compatible with the neighborhood character of Highland Estates, which is required by the development code?
Yeah. Well, I'm in a little bit of a tough spot since we haven't really considered it and gone on public record. It's tough for me to actually get into personal opinions. I think in a prior work session, we talked about challenges here, and those challenges remain. We know that from a character perspective, the applicant is asking for some changes to the general plan. I think recognizing that as the Highland Estates neighborhood plan is written, there's some real challenges here. The neighborhood objective for Highland Estates right out of the general plan is to reinforce the use of detached single family residential structures. And, that's not what this project is. So recognizing that they're asking for changes. I think before you get into even the character of the neighborhood, there's a threshold question of general plan policy 2.3 and whether this project, serves a countervailing public interest delivers on community benefits essentially that would allow an increase in density. In the general plan, we have what is essentially a moratorium on new growth until all the outstanding entitlements that aren't built get built. And so to go around that, there have to be significant community benefits. And so we'd have to prove that here to approve it.
Sure, that certainly is another hurdle, the provision 2.3. And I guess, what do you look at to decide whether or not it is or isn't a compelling public benefit? As we've heard from so many, they can't afford to live here. Having an affordable place to live would be great.
It's a tough one because that policy doesn't tell you what the countervailing public interests are. And so I think it's up to each individual commissioner and ultimately the council to look at the context of today. And it's, I think not getting into, well, we approved XYZ before for this reason. So now that reason, say affordable housing is a coin of the realm. It's really what is the specific context of this development? Does it deliver affordable housing? What's the pipeline look like today versus the pipeline of affordable housing from the past? Does this development have the right transit? Is it the right place for affordable housing? And whatever those benefits are, I just think it's looking at the specific context of this application and deciding whether it meets the bar.
Yeah, well, we know that single-family homes certainly aren't going to go there, given that it's right next to two major highways. So I guess if there's not a, if this isn't the place to build affordable housing, I mean, where is?
It's a good question. And it's probably one I can't answer. Yeah. One challenge I think to affordable housing on that site is probably transit. You know, we talked about that. That's so critical for affordable housing. When we talk in any new density in the basin, we always talk about making sure that's on transit. We're not trying to add a whole lot of additional cars that scale to the people that we're adding there. You know, I think the case for this being part of our sort of nodal transit objective is that it's close to 80 and 40, but the access is not, you know, from the site. It's actually, you leave the site and access, you know, 80 from an underpass that may not serve that density, or from the other end going, going through Old Ranch Road or out to 240 to get to 248. You know, that's probably a challenge to it as a location for affordable housing relative to some other proposals that we've heard.
Yeah. On the traffic impact information from the applicant, will this be vetted then by the county engineering staff?
Yes, I think, even the applicant, I think, was characterized it as a sort of traffic memo. This was not a full-blown traffic study. It wasn't vetted by the county engineer. There was a question about, county numbers, UDOT numbers. This was really a big picture look at traffic. I think some of the comments we did have by commissioners were asking some questions about that traffic study and some critique of the study that the applicant I think took and accepted, which is always good. But if we think about the application, I think in terms of the threshold question of 2.3, the threshold question of the neighborhood character and other general plan changes, if you were to get through an approval of those threshold questions, then you get to all the stuff that really related to what we heard from the public about traffic and wildlife and air and light pollution and trails and transit. And that's where we would absolutely have to have a full-blown traffic study that was vetted by the county.
Yeah, because I think one planning commissioner raised that he thought that the applicant had undercounted the current volume by 1,000 trips. That's significant.
It is. It is. And, the county measures traffic one way, UDOT measures it a different way. I think making sure we're using consistent numbers from consistent sources, making sure we're looking traffic, probably more broadly looking at it. The traffic is different in either direction on the road. We don't want to just use a static count of the road, and looking at the impact to intersections beyond simply Highland Drive. You know, there was a question about the backup at the underpass closer to Kimball Junction. So if you add so many additional cars, what happens when that backs up onto Highland Drive? So I would expect the traffic study to get into downstream effects and hopefully I would imagine that would be the applicant's plan and when we got to that point and something that we'd ask for.
Yeah, and you did mention wildlife, so that's something that we will also kind of vet. I mean, we certainly heard from at least one person, the irony is that the elk used to be where these people are living, and because of the development got pushed to where they are going now. But I guess that's something that you will be looking at as part of this?
We would look at wildlife. That's part of our criteria for approval of development. And, we actually earlier in the meeting had a discussion about the sustainability section of the general plan as we're updating that. And, wildlife fencing was a part of that discussion. And there's a lot of question about there are sort of the two poles of the discussion are, I think, from the applicant side, some data from, wildlife folks saying this isn't a good place for the elk. And I think we heard from the neighborhood and others saying it may not be a great place for the elk, but the elk are there. I think we heard that the elk don't seem to mind. We do want to make sure that our wildlife has the right places to go, but for now they do seem to go there. So that's absolutely something that we would have to tackle.
All right, let's see. You'll take it up again, my understanding, March 9th. Any guesses if you could get to a decision by then?
You know, I think there's a very good chance that we'll have a decision on that day. Again, we haven't heard from other commissioners, but there's, you know, it would probably be more likely. You know, I think we're going to have a discussion about those threshold questions, which, as complex as the project is, when you talk about policy 2.3 and the criteria in the general plan for to approve the rezone and the general plan change, those are actually fairly probably simple conversations. So if you weren't able to clear those hurdles, then probably a decision is easier in one meeting. If the commission felt those could be overcome, then you're really getting into all the nuts and bolts of the development agreement, and that would probably stretch longer. So I guess I'd probably look at it that way. A no would be a quicker decision to come to than a yes, and we'll just take the temperature of the commissioners and see how folks feel at that meeting.
All right. On another topic, I wanted to bring up just briefly. Planning commissioners set along a negative recommendation on the request from the Colony Homeowners Association. They wanted to use 10 parcels for employee housing, private maintenance facilities, as well as a private homeowners association lodge. And I'm simplifying a lot here, but it sounded like the county staff said that the colony was just supposed to have residential development and it can't increase density without providing benefits. I guess I would just ask, isn't employee housing a benefit?
Employee housing is a benefit, and HOA private maintenance facilities are a benefit. So getting plows and saw trucks off the road and into the development is important. The staff report and in the discussion among the commission, you know, we talked about can you sort of slice and dice the recommendation, for lack of a better word, to say, you know, a private on mountain facility, you know, private club for the colony in within the resort doesn't really meet the intent of the colony spa, but certainly some of those other provisions could. The applicant was very clear. You know, the colony coming to us said, this is one project. This is a list of items that we want to do. We're looking for an up and down vote. We don't want approvals and denials of specific pieces. And I think, you know, at some point you have to respect the request from the applicant themselves. It's a one cohesive project, and we gave them the up or down decision that they wanted. And clearly there were some things that the commission was uncomfortable with, and so that turned into a down.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention, Ryan?
No, I'll tell you, I do. We've talked a lot about the Zoom, and I think this was a really interesting meeting, and that we're getting closer probably to going back to meeting in person. And something that really struck me from this meeting is we had 238 people on Zoom at one point, and we had feedback from 55 or 60, however many folks gave us feedback. And a lot of those, you know, we had parents saying, hey, I'm in the middle of bedtime, but thanks for calling on me, and gave feedback. We had a lot of voices who would not have come to the Richens building and that we would not have heard from had we met in person. And it really struck me, and 238 people wouldn't fit in the room. So just really struck me that it's probably a challenge, a task for us as we think about going back to meet in person, which is a lot better from a commission perspective in terms of our discussion, but figuring out how we continue to have all these voices, because as long as that hearing was, we had folks say things we hadn't thought of and voices that we don't see at the Richens building. And so I don't know, I think that's a task ahead of us probably for all of our public meetings as we think about how to bring technology into the physical location or whatever it is. How do we keep that public input going?
Okay. Ryan, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks, Leslie.
That's the chair of the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission, Ryan Dickey. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, Park City Film has launched its private film screenings in the Jim Santee Auditorium. On the phone with details, I have the executive director of Park City Film, Katie Wang. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the city council gave you permission to do what exactly?
So what we asked for was the opportunity to make private screenings available to the public on Friday and Saturday nights, for groups of up to 30 people. Because what we were seeing is that while theaters have been open for a while in various parts of the country, there's been a general reluctance to be in a closed space with people you don't know. And so we thought this would be a great way to kind of get people back into the theater, remind them of just, you know, how intense and powerful that experience is, to be back and seeing movies on the, you know, on the big screen with folks that you know and like. but to do it in a, you know, in a kind of a controlled environment, if you will. And we've heard from other theaters around the country that it's been quite successful. And so we went to city council and said, hey, this is something we've never tried before, but, you know, can we give it a whirl and see if people respond to it positively? And they really have, which has been amazing. We're actually already booked out through the end of March, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah. So why just Friday and Saturday nights then?
Just to kind of give the experiment, we'll add more dates if people, we've added more dates into April. Originally we were just going to go, offer weekends in February and then into March. And what we were seeing, which makes sense, of course, is that as people are kind of getting their second shot of their vaccine, immediately all the end dates got booked, right? Because people said, oh, I've got my second shot and I'll feel more comfortable being inside at that point. And so we went into April. And so we're just, you know, we're a small staff, so we're trying to keep it manageable for us. This isn't going to be a huge revenue generator, but it is a way to kind of stay relevant and to meet the needs. We're hearing from a lot of folks how much they miss not just seeing movies in a theater, but that community that we've created around film. And so, again, trying to kind of ease into that. And then, you know, with the eye, of course, to opening up to general public screenings, hopefully later this spring.
So the person that books then pays how much?
So it's $350 for just a member of the general public. And then if you're a member of Park City Film, it's $250. And then what we've done is curate a selection of films that people can choose from to see. And these are all films that are, most of the films are fairly new. We've got Night of the Kings, which just premiered here at the 2020 Film Festival. And this is a film from the Ivory Coast, and it's been shortlisted for an Academy Award. It's kind of an Arabian Nights type theme, but kind of the power of storytelling. The Climb, which we got to interview, you and I, Leslie, the directors last year at Sundance, and just came out this winter, which is a comedy about friendship and how friends can feed your soul, but also drive you a little crazy. Nomadland, which is up for a couple of Golden Globes this weekend, starring Frances McDormand, and it's kind of about modern day nomads who travel around the Western US and live outside of conventional society. One Night in Miami, which we saw last weekend, which is a clever reimagining of a conversation about fame and political action, the obligation of Black celebrities, and with featuring Cassius Clay, Malcolm X, Jim Brown, the football player, and Sam Cooke, the singer. And this is set in 1964 after Cassius Clay had won the heavyweight boxing title. And then the last film is Herself, which is a little bit of an older film, premiered in the fall, which is a Sundance Film Festival about a young mother who has escaped an abusive relationship only to be having to combat a broken housing system in Ireland and trying to rebuild her life. So kind of a selection of films. We wanted it to be curatorial in the way that we always present films, not just, you know, bring your DVD and throw it up on the screen. And, you know, to offer the opportunity for people to see films that, you know, that they would normally see in a movie theater in a normal year. So kind of timing it that way. So it's been interesting to see what films are gravitating. I'd say Nomadland so far has been the most popular of all of the titles. But, you know, we're seeing some interest in all of them, which is really exciting.
Yeah. So the person that the books it, then they get to invite the other 29 people.
Yes. And so we ask for contact information for all the folks that are invited so we can do contact tracing. Of course, we're following all, state and county health guidelines. That's something we've been working on with the city and the county health department since the fall, honestly. And so we'll still maintain that 6-foot perimeter around seat clusters so that we can offer concessions. So if you've been thirsting, dying for your popcorn with real butter, we can definitely make that available for your screening. Of course, enhanced ventilation, enhanced cleaning, masks are required per county ordinance, except of course when you're eating. So we're following all of those, you know, COVID protocols. But yes, you can bring your group of 30 people that, you'd like to come see a movie with. So we've had birthday parties, we've had celebrations, we're having Mountain Town Stages come with their board, which is fun, just kind of a celebration for them, a way to get together and celebrate music and film. And so it's been interesting to see some of the folks. There's some familiar faces and some folks who are entirely new to Park City Film and just are excited about the opportunity to do something different.
Yeah, well, back to the protocols that you take, and I mean, are you requiring people to fill out some kind of health form or take their temperature or anything like that?
So they, as part of the kind of the private screening agreement, they have to agree to, kind of a certain set of guidelines that they will, of course, wear masks, that they will not, that they're not exhibiting any COVID symptoms, they haven't been exposed to COVID, you know, the kind of the rules, I think, that at this point we've all become used to. But no, we don't take temperatures at the door. That becomes a little bit kind of challenging when we've talked to other theaters. But yes, everyone has to certify that they are, that they're not sick. And what we're seeing is it's a lot of people that have been vaccinated already. And so, you know, that adds kind of a certain level of protection as well, which is nice to see.
Okay. So the concessions are extra then? It's not included in the price?
Correct. Yeah, it'd just be concessions available for purchase. So you can get your candy, your drinks, your popcorn. And then we do ask that people, right now we're booking out dates from April 10th through the 24th, so Friday and Saturday nights. And then we ask for 72-hour notice. You know, we're a small staff and a lot of our staff have other jobs. So we want to make sure that we're scheduling people appropriately, making sure we're getting in the films from the studios and that we're ready for the screenings. And if we see, you know, an overwhelming amount of interest in those April dates, then we'll certainly consider adding on Sunday nights. Those are typically our more popular nights during a regular season. But we thought that probably now Friday and Saturday would be a good place to start. And that's certainly been a response, you know, the positive response certainly lends us to believe that that was a good decision. And then screening time is at 7 o'clock, so different than our normal time, but we'll open the doors at 6:30. Folks can come in and get their concessions, settle in, and then we don't run trailers. So you pretty much start right on time and, you know, have your hour and a half, 2 hour experience of watching movies in a cinema. And it's, you know, as I said, we watched One Night in Miami last weekend and it was just, I mean, it's like it almost brings tears to your eyes. It was so powerful. And it's such an intense movie anyway, but just to kind of be immersed in it again and to hear people around you reacting, it's just, you know, I knew I missed it, but I didn't realize how much I missed it until I was back in the theater. And that's certainly what people were saying as well, that they were just thrilled to be back.
All right. Let's see. You've got some new films in your virtual cinema. Tell us about that.
Yes. Yep. And so that's important to us as well. So we want to make sure that people know that while we're doing these private screenings, you know, we know that's not certainly for everyone. And so we will continue with our virtual cinema, you know, at least until the end. We're looking probably at least until the end of the year, and we're making some upgrades to that experience. We've heard from people over the past year, they're getting more comfortable with the technology, but having different platforms where you have to create different login and password and sign on is kind of exhausting for people. So we're in the process of streamlining our virtual cinema experience, having one interface where you can pay for and watch films, which is exciting. And our two new films this week are Crock of Gold, A Few Rounds with Shane McGowan. It's about the former lead singer of the Pogues and kind of a moving portrait of a self-destructive talent. And then next week we'll be bringing in Stray, which is an interesting documentary about street dogs in Istanbul, where they're allowed to roam free because there is no, they basically decided that they're not going to euthanize the dogs and they're not going to capture them. They just kind of let them be, which is interesting. And it really provides an unusual window into the world and life of the dispossessed. So not only the dogs, but the people that befriend them, who are, you know, in some cases refugees and, you know, somewhat of strays themselves. And then of course we'll be adding more titles, both to the virtual cinema as well as to the private screenings as we go forward. But you can go to parkcityfilm.org, check out trailers, read all the details on the private screenings and all of our health and safety protocols, and then certainly reach out and book a film night with us. We'd love to see you there, and we're excited to see all of our film lovers back in the theater.
Okay, and then briefly just tell us, you do have this new platform to kind of streamline the virtual cinema experience. How does that work?
So that'll be actually launching. We're just in the process of setting it all up, so that'll probably be in a couple of weeks. And so normally you'll go in if you watch a film through Park City Film, and you know, you buy, you know, quote unquote, buy your ticket, and then you have to log into whatever platform it is. It's usually Event Live. Vimeo Plus also has a platform. I think right now we have four different platforms, and so they have various ways that you have to connect with them, various windows for how long you can watch the film. And, you know, again, we're hearing from people that while it's, you know, it's great to be able to see films in this way, that it can be somewhat confusing. So with the new platform, you're actually working directly with Park City Film. It kind of puts a layer over these other platforms. And so you just have one username and password. We'll be able to make discounts available for our members, which is great. Something we've been hoping to do for the past year and finally are able to do it. And then you purchase your ticket as you normally would for your screening. And then, you know, depending on what the film is, you'll have, you know, a couple days to watch it or rewatch it if you like. So it just gives us a little more flexibility in terms of how we price the films, and then just gives that simplicity of just saying, okay, here's my one username, here's my one password. I don't need four different ones and then have to figure out who am I, you know, which platform am I interacting with this particular film. So, but otherwise we're able to offer films from all the major distributors and still offer a curated film experience the way we have been for the past year. So, you know, still have that kind of unique aspect to it.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
No, just want to thank everyone for their support. You know, all along through the pandemic, it's been great to hear from folks and certainly helped us get as far as we have. And just, you know, please check out our private screenings. And, you know, we hope to be back in the spring. But parkcityfilm.org for all that information. And thanks for watching.
Okay. Katie Wang, Executive Director of Park City Film. Thanks. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW.